Gold. Everyone's talking about gold these days. Gold records are the new gold bullion, some are saying. Maybe. Maybe not. But multi-platinum records, including gold and oldies, are reportedly generating more streaming revenue today than ever. And music professionals are saying hot music catalogs will continue to shine even as more traditional investments, your stocks, bonds, treasuries, real estate are fading away in a frankly rocking and roiling economy. The times, they are changing when it comes to valuations of music assets and have been for some time. Bob Dylan says in his memoir that in 1962, he signed his first music publishing deal for $100. He's quoted as saying, quote, "Company advanced me $100 against future royalties to sign the paper. Oh, and that was fine with me." So says Bob, and he smartly was able to get back his song copyrights and 58 years later sold some 600 songs for some $300 million. That's some sum, isn't it? From $100 to $300 million. Pretty nice appreciation. And buyers are out there panning for more golden opportunities for gold catalogs that may be available, maybe shaking loose. On the other hand, some are not interested in selling. Well, I have two brilliant guests on the podcast today to discuss whether we saw the peak of catalog sales a few years ago when Dylan, Springsteen, Bowie, and others sold their music rights for some very steep sums. Or whether we haven't crested the summit of that gold mountain quite yet. Laurent Hubert is the CEO of Cobalt Music, a major player in the music publishing world, whose clients include Paul McCartney, Foo Fighters, and many others. And Jeff Biederman is an A-list music business attorney at Greenberg Traurig. I also write about our illuminating conversation in a Forbes article, which is included in the show materials. Obviously, there's no legal or financial advice here, folks. Got to make that disclaimer. But let's get jamming, shall we? Well, I'm really excited to have both of you on, and I wanted to start out just with a little personal journey information. How did you get into the music business? And Laurent, maybe just tell us a bit about that. How did you get into the music business?
Mostly by accident, I have to say. So I always loved music. Music was always playing in the background of my life. And I grew up in France, as you probably can tell, and my parents love music. We don't watch a lot of TV, but we had a lot of music at home. So I always had an affinity for music. It was very much part of my identity, but never thought that it would ever be at some point my career. I started my career in the hospitality business. And then I went to grad school, and between my first and second year, BMG was a recruiting internship on campus. And that's how I got my first exposure to music. I walked to the booth and say, "Hey, I'm interested. What do you have?" And there were two different opportunities. One was in on the master side, the recorded music side, on marketing, international marketing. And the other one was publishing. I had two interviews, one with somebody I do not remember the name on the label side, and the other interview was with Nick Firth, who ran at the time BMG. And I immediately sort of fell in love with publishing. And the reason for that is I love storytelling. And I see music publishing at the very genesis of the creative process. And I had a great interaction with Nick during this interview, and he offered me an internship, and that's how it all started.
So you went from internship to CEO. So you are now CEO of Cobalt Music.
That's
Pretty
right.
good. Pretty nice.
That's right. Well, not overnight.
Oh.
It only took 20 odd years or so, but I am very blessed and very lucky.
Oh, well, great. And Jeff, tell us a little bit about your journey as well. And we, some of us as old as me, remember your father, Don Biederman, a legendary music attorney and educator about music at most of the universities around here. And you are a great music attorney yourself. Tell us a little bit about how you got into it.
Well, as you say, I mean, there used to be the ABA had a great entertainment and sports lawyers convention, and they used to kick it off every year, like 7 a.m. There was a breakfast, they go, the young lawyers breakfast, which I no longer qualify for, obviously. But for 3 or 4 years in a row, I was a speaker at that. And you always get, you know, the question, how do you get in the music business? And I always say, the easiest way is genetics, right? But no, I came out of law school and I was assigned, I worked on Wall Street for a firm called Brown & Wood, which is now part of Sidley Austin. And I was assigned to litigation and I was doing products liability work and then moved down to Atlanta and I was doing employment law. But big firm employment law, you are, if you're a lefty and I was and am, you know, you're not frequently wearing the white hat. Right, you're helping large companies fire handicapped people, pregnant people, old people, the kind of stuff that made you feel great at the holidays. And oh, my father survived.
Sarcasm alert. Okay.
Right. So my old man survived this crazy surgery, and I flew home from Atlanta and decided somewhere over Nebraska, I was going to try to make music work. And the marketplace was very hot. A friend and I hung out a shingle and started getting baby bands signed, and that was 30 years ago. So I've been doing entertainment ever since.
Wow. Okay. Well, great. And so we're going to talk about catalog sales. And let's just jump right in there. And I'll put it to either one of you. You know, why are music catalogs a good bet for a buyer today?
I can start if you want, whatever.
Please.
Well, I think it's important to sort of look back a little bit and see what has been the transformation in the music business over the past 10, 15 years. You know, we had an industry, as we all know, that between 2002 and 2015 was declining. And that was not as much true for publishing, but certainly we didn't see any growth. And the recorded music, obviously, was deeply impacted by the transformation of our business. And we went from essentially an ownership model to a consumption model. And in that meantime, we went from a few hundred million buyers from an addressable market perspective to billions of consumers and users. So that was a fundamental shift. And if you think about what that means in the context of the underlying earnings of a music asset, that's a game changer, absolute game changer. So from that perspective, I think music is attractive because it's a growing category. And if I look in the next 5 to 10 years, I personally feel particularly bullish in terms of music earnings. So we've seen, obviously, the adoption and the growth of a subscription model over essentially a number of large markets, not only developed markets, but also developing markets. We've seen the capacity for those subscription model to also increase prices. We've seen that recently in the past couple of years, and that is obviously strengthening revenue of music assets. I think it's fair to say that the non-traditional streaming, and I mean by that the social media transformation of our business, so you look at a TikTok, you look at a YouTube Shorts and many other platforms, that is also another contributor of acceleration of growth. And then more broadly, I think if you think about the collection ecosystem that we've seen, this has improved where leakage is declining, meaning that you don't lose as much money between the source of earning all the way down to the recipient of those earnings. And I expect that to continue to improve. And I think lastly, even in developing markets, when a lot of people are concerned about streaming, for instance, which is true, there's obviously naturally a leveling of growth. But the reality is those are competitive markets, and therefore the market participants have to compete with each other, and they have to find ways to differentiate with each other, which means that they need to create product features that will require a broader scope of rights. And as a result of that, publishers and others have the ability to monetize those rights. So if you start adding all those factors, I think that music is a great asset. It is generally uncorrelated to the economy, and I think we've proven that during COVID. Obviously, we had an economic stoppage, and yet music continued to flow, and even usage went up. I would say there's some caveat to that. You know, I think a lot of debt has come into the business, and when you have large amount of debt, you are somewhat correlated to the economy. You cannot ignore interest rate, and obviously, interest rate are heavily correlated with the economy. But overall, you're looking at a category that is growing, fairly uncorrelated. And from that perspective, I think music is in a unique position.
And Jeff, what do you think? What about like music assets? Is it a good thing that I want to buy a huge catalog like Dylan's catalog versus a huge real estate investment? I mean, it is music. Do you agree that it's holds up really well? Regardless of the economy, or what do you think? Or if the economy takes a hit, I know this question is sort of all over the place, but help me out here. Why would I want to buy a music catalog if I were an investor or a private equity or a fund or a label wanting to buy more catalog?
It's been a bull market for a long, long time, Bill. I mean, I think probably longer than a lot of people expected it to be. But look, we're in... regardless of your political stripe, these are rocky times. And in difficult times, people tend to want to be entertained. So we do tend, as Laurent was suggesting, we tend to be countercyclical. You know, when the you-know-what hits the fan, people go to the movies. They listen to music. It's an escape valve. So I think in turbulent times, it's probably a great investment. Also, you don't really tariff music, right? So in a way, we are somewhat insulated from what's going on in the general economy at the moment.
We hope he doesn't tariff music, but yes,
we hope. Let's not give them any ideas, but at the moment it's pretty good, and it's been a really healthy market. I think Laurent's been right at the forefront of this, but you know, you have the traditional buyers, right, which kept the market strong, but you know, you have all the non-music money that's been coming in, so all kinds of investment from banks and venture capitalists. So it's been a really, really strong market. You know, there are some headwinds. Money's more expensive than it used to be. And I think, you know, what's happened with, there have been some market players that have stumbled, and that has cooled the market a little bit, but it remains strong.
So, yeah, I don't know if we would call it peak catalog sale, but 2020, Dylan sells his catalog to Universal Music Group for $300 million. And around that, a little after that, Springsteen, his catalog for over $500 million, according to reports. Right. Now, Dylan, so he had 600 songs, like roughly, or so for three. That's $500,000 per song. And this is an interesting case study because he actually retained 100% of his songs, which is sort of unusual. And even more unusual, back in the 60s, he was able to, with his manager at the time, Albert Grossman, to negotiate an unusual deal without getting too into the weeds here. But they kept 100% of, or they had a co-publishing deal initially, which was unusual back in 1962. And it was only for 28 years, which again, without getting too geeky here, is the initial copyright term. Unusual. So by 1990, he got back most of his songs, and he was able to settle with Grossman as well. I think there was a lawsuit, but he sold it to Universal in 2020, 30 years later, after 1990, getting it all back for a princely sum. And here's my question, though, to you guys, is that unlike, say, real estate or other investments, music copyrights don't last forever, right? They go into the public domain. So his songs from like 1960s, you know, they're going to, there's about a 95 year term. So in the mid 2060s or so, they're going to start going into the public domain. So you got like a 30 to 40 year life. Whereas with, say, real estate or something, Unless there's a Cuban-style communist revolution, we're not going to have like real estate going into the public domain. But music does. So again, if I'm an investor, what are you going to tell me if I say, well, that's, you know, 30 or 40 year lifespan on these songs? I mean, it's Dylan, sure, but will that hold up? And will people even know about Dylan in 20 or 30 years? I'm throwing a lot at you guys, but you can take it. I know you can take it. So,
well, I don't want to argue against real estate, but, and not to be flippant, but yeah, real estate's forever, but you know, real estate in the Palisades is not what it was a few months ago, right?
Say that so, again.
You know, terrible things, or Times River, or you know, pick out your environmental disaster site, or you know, climate changing, right? The winds will blow, the rains may come, but people still listen to Dylan. And you know, when you buy a catalog, you know, and this is really my friend's wheelhouse more than mine, but each purchaser has their secret sauce, and their accountants and their finance people break this down, and they analyze what the earnings are, and they make a projection, and of course build in a profit, and you know, it keeps humming along. And look, will things will run out? I mean, you know, what do they call it? The last one was the Mickey Mouse Extension Act, the New York Times. Who knows? You know, it's a limited use monopoly that Congress created, and there's an awful lot of very powerful lobbyists that are always trying to extend it. And who knows? Maybe it gets longer. I don't know. But it would
incredibly great point. Although Elon Musk says he wants to eliminate IP law, but assuming that's not going to happen, I love that point.
Your work deserves more than attention. It deserves protection. Rains is trusted by artists, producers, and creatives across the industry. With offices in Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, and beyond, we bring sharp legal thinking to litigation, business, real estate, and private client matters, protecting tomorrow and delivering today. We've got you. Rains.
And Laurent, like in France, for example, is American Legacy Catalog going to hold up for 20, 30 years without some help somehow? How do you keep a catalog alive like that?
Let me first, I think you asked two questions in one, which is, have we peaked? And then you cited those examples, which are, I would say, unique examples of transactions. So typically, if you think about the fundamentals of value, it's typically driven by a growth or anticipated growth, and also by scarcity, right? So if you look at assets such as Dylan or Springsteen's or others in that sort of very small club, if I may call it that way, scarcity is certainly a factor of value, right? Growth is another one. I mean, I think going back to what we said earlier, I think we feel pretty strongly about, as a category, that music will continue to grow. Now, of course, you're also asking a fair question. You're using the example of France. Would those catalogs continue to be relevant, right? And that, to me, is the challenge for any of those buyers or owners of those assets, to ensure the relevance of those catalogs and find every possible way to monetize and maximize. But my personal belief is that we have not reached peak. We will see other peaks. There will be, of course, market distortions, and that will be for very unique assets, not dissimilar to some real estate. When you have a unique piece of real estate that can't be replicated and no one else can get it, that tend to drive value. To the point of public domain, you tend to factor all of this in the exercise of valuation, right? So obviously, public domain is factored in your future revenue flow. And as you know, Jeff said, there might be an opportunity to extend on some of those rights. Yeah, I'll give you a small example of that. I used to be involved in a business where we had a lot of classical rights. Naturally, those rights are much older than I would define as current catalogs. And some of those were going to public domain, but there were ways to recapture some copyright by creating critical editions of those rights. And that was true for classical music, and you had the ability to reprotect those rights for the duration of copyright. I am not certain necessarily that you have an exact analogy to that, to what I would define as more traditional repertoire, but there are ways, and I think we will find ways to extend the life of those copyrights.
Certainly, yeah, and music value, music as a commodity, according to Illuminate 2023 data, Illuminate the company, global music streaming in 2023 surged by 34% to 7.1 trillion streams, with catalog music, according to that study, was in the US 72.6% of the US market, overshadowing new releases that were only 27%. So I mean, catalog stuff, legacy stuff is strong, and certainly, you know, very strong. And so what do you do as a company? And you are the worldwide head of Kobo, which is really a very significant, great company. What do you do to, if you have buy a huge catalog and or any catalog, what kinds of things you hear about documentaries? I represent the Curtis Mayfield estate. If I can give a little plug here, we just launched a documentary that is at South by Southwest in Austin that her, the artist, H.E.R. Gabby Wilson, directed. It's wonderful. I won't plug for too long here, but it is unusual because it's musicians and filmmakers talking about the music. It's really about the music. And you know, Dre invited her and the camera crew out to his house, and they were in the studio that he has there, like listening to the song Pusher Man and going, wait, I didn't know there were horns, and there weren't, but we have the multi-tracks. Let's listen to the horns, that kind of thing. And getting it to a young audience, because her has a younger audience. So what do you do? Because the mission, right, is to get the legacy, that your catalogs to live for decades in the future. How do you get it to the younger audience? What kinds of things can you do, and it's a very crowded market and a tough market with documentaries out there. But what kinds of stuff can you do to keep a legacy alive so people know? I mean, you talk to somebody in their 20s, you know, you say, have you ever heard of the Jefferson Airplane, or even Mick Jagger? I heard somebody say their daughter didn't know, they had heard of the song Dances Like Jagger, but not Mick Jagger. You know what I mean? How do you keep it alive?
Well, first, you need to collect every penny that you're making today, right? Let's start with the foundation, right? The reality, and this is especially true for music publishing, when I first joined the business in 1999, this was the year of Napster, by the way, which was an interesting milestone in the industry. About two-thirds of the income on publishing was mechanical. And I mean by that physical mechanical. Right? This was in 1999. You fast forward nearly 26 years ahead, and today, at least speaking for Cobalt, and I assume most large players, it won't be dissimilar to that ratio, about 70% of our income is digital. So you've had an ecosystem that became a lot more complex in the past 25 years, much more so than it was on the recorded music business, because you could argue that on the recorded music business, things got simpler because you don't have to manage manufacturing, you don't have to manage inventory, you don't have to manage a retail environment. But when you look at publishing, what you've had in those 25 years, an explosion of OLT data. So just to give you a sense, at the level of Cobalt, we manage about $100 billion a year royalty transactions. You've had an explosion of income sources, so you have to manage that as effectively as you can. And you've also had a fragmentation of ownership. It's not uncommon today to have 5, 7, 8 publishers or writers on a song. So you need first to build an infrastructure that can harness that complexity, so you connect every penny. And that matters, because the leakage in the ecosystem is not single digit, right? This is much higher than single digit. So at the size of an industry that is roughly $10 billion, imagine if you're looking at 10% leakage on a static basis. That's right there, you know, $1 billion of opportunity and growth. The second aspect that you have to do, obviously, is making sure that your repertoire continues to be relevant. And you cited an example of a documentary, that's one of them, but it could be many other things. It could be sampling, it could be synchronization. There's a number of things that you can do. What we've seen today is that there's more than ever opportunities to link up with brands. You know, it used to be that we're in a world where we're linking up with maybe an advertising agency, maybe with a studio. But I think music, and that's the benefit of music, and going back to the very first question you asked me, music, unlike a book, is a video game or a film, is something you can experience very easily. So it's at a perfect crossroad of ease of consumption and high engagement. And you need to leverage the value of that, right? Which is why also on social media, that's the third sort of aspect, and say, once you've collected well, once you've exploited well and all those opportunities, you need to leverage your rights and negotiate appropriately so you recapture that value. So all those things compounded do create value. It's not a single thing. It's a pretty complex exercise to do.
It sure is, yeah. And you mentioned video games, and that's sort of becoming like the new radio for kids to discover music. I mean, they listen to, and they listen to old songs as well as new stuff. So it's an opportunity.
Think about video games. You have 3 billion gamers in the world. 3 billion. That's a big number. And you don't really have today any real music integration to video games. That will happen. That will happen. You know, we are working on those opportunities, as I'm sure others are. This is not a COBOL-specific statement. And that would also be a source of growth. So, and talking about a new audience, that's the next 15 years on.
The integration, you mean like not a royalty system, really? I mean, depend, like, I mean, how many times it plays? Because a kid will listen to the same song 40 times, or a group of kids in a row.
I mean the experience of bringing music to the video, right? You know, let me give you an example. My goddaughter, she might be playing on a video game. She might be talking and WhatsApping with one of her friends, and at the same time listening to something else on her with her headset. If suddenly you were to integrate those two other experiences in addition to the video game, that you could chat and have access to music, yeah, you would increase massively the use of music, right? Those could be the next Spotify. It could be the next TikTok, right? So, and I firmly believe in that, right? And I'm not suggesting it's happening tomorrow, but those type of integration from an experiential perspective will change the game in terms of consumption.
Right. And so why is a music company a better buyer of a legacy or any kind of music catalog than, say, just a investment house or a bank, private equity firm? Is there something about a music company that makes them better able to keep the legacy alive and expand the legacy?
Jeff, you want to take this on?
Well, I'm not sure if it's better, Bill, but you know, look, I'm in the process of selling a pretty big legacy catalog, and that was part of the math that the client was going through, right? Because if it's simply out for the biggest check, you know, you can certainly go for a company that flips, or a company that's backed by big money in New York, or, I mean, one of the folks that approached us, you know, some random golf money, right, to somebody collecting a trophy to put on his or her shelf. And you really have to kind of take your client's temperature. Is the goal to make the biggest final payout, or to have potentially a better guardian for the legacy? And this particular client I'm talking about, I mean, the legacy was critical for them. So for them, they wanted to go to a company that was music focused, as opposed to necessarily whatever they got the best return. But don't you That's find great. That in your practice too? I mean, yep. The most important thing is to find out how the client defines success. Otherwise, it's awfully difficult to work your way towards success if you don't know what they, you know, how they define it.
I mean, exactly.
But it depends. I mean, I agree with what Jeff said. But then the question is, better for whom, right? I mean, it depends which perspective you have. But what I would say is a strategic buyer who has deep knowledge of the asset, deep connection in the industry, will most likely create value, right? So there is they it's unlikely they'll damage an asset, right? They probably will build on that asset. But I would not also discount a financial sponsor, because one of the benefits of financial sponsor is that they're not tethered to any legacy. They're not tethered to a lot of things that in some cases are limiting optionality because we think in a particular way versus a financial sponsor. I say, you know what? We're going to look at something completely different. We're going to be doing that type of licensing. We're going to be willing to do this and experiment that. So I think at the end of the day, it's the combination of both that creates value, and you have great financial sponsor owners that do a great job, right? And you have great strategic owners that do a great job. And by the way, learning from each other. And yeah. I'm uniquely positioned to say that because if you look at Cobalt, we spend quite a bit of money on a music IP, and we did it typically via a financial sponsor. We had a fund one, a fund two, we currently have a fund with Morgan Stanley. So those are the type of conversations where we are absolutely aligned, is how do we create value, right? And certainly how do we make sure we don't hurt the asset? That's rule number one, right? So I think it's a combination of thoughts and competency. And I think both sides are bringing something interesting to the equation and hopefully creating value.
Yeah, I agree with that. And you have, you have some estates, for example, of legacy songwriters and artists with many heirs, and sometimes you are having fights. You read about the James Brown estate, and you read more recently about Robbie Robertson. Hopefully, working that, all of that is working out. But it is an issue. I would imagine that if an estate sells the catalog, then there would presumably be less friction because it's not being run by perhaps competing heirs and things like that. What do you think about that?
Well, it's easier to divide up money than to have, you know, get approval from some fractious families. But I think that is a factor for people. If their kids or their various family members can't get along, it's a lot easier to divide up cash than approval rights.
A lot easier. I think when you are a seller, you know, I explain that to people who are selling. I always ask them, I say, why are you selling? Right? Because they're going to land with a big pot of money, but what are they going to do with it? Right? And to me, I sort of from a high level, I tell them there are four reasons to sell, and I go from the worst reasons to sell to the best reasons to sell. Right? The worst reasons to sell is I need money. That's the worst reason to sell. But sometimes, unfortunately, people get themselves in that position and they have to sell. So when they have to sell, they don't pick the time. This can be in a down market. This could be in a situation where there's not as many market participants, so you're not going to get price tension in what you want. The second reason you may want to sell is because you want to diversify your assets. You've been in, most of your assets are tied up into music assets. And guess what? It's never a good idea to have most of your wealth into a single category. So the idea of diversifying is sensible, right? So it's a better reason to consider a sale. The third reason is, as Jeff explained, is sometimes estate planning is a better option, right? It's better because you feel that you can extract more value than have potentially heirs fighting with each other, right? And the best reason is if somebody is giving you an ungodly price that makes no sense and is an irrational buyer, then you should sell, right? But those are sort of the big four categories, from the worst to, if you're very lucky, to the best.
And so we've been talking a lot about legacy artists and their catalogs, which have a proven track record. But let's look at a new artist who has achieved some success. You know, it's a different music business now than it was 20, 30 years, 40 years ago, more. But should they sell, and is there as much of a market? You know, I mentioned earlier that this Luminate study showed that actually, legacy catalog is outperforming new release music, like the top 200 tracks on Billboard are being outperformed by legacy in some senses in terms of global streaming for the top stuff. So what if I'm I am a new artist or composer and I have some hot songs, Why would I want to sell? And what is the marketplace looking like for a new artist compared with, I mean, is there as much demand for buying up catalog of a newer artist as a legacy artist?
Jeff, do you want to take this or?
Go for it.
Yeah. I mean, I would say my observation is that more recent repertoire is not subject to the same level of demand and established repertoire, right? And for a couple of reasons. A, because that implies that you understand the earning curves of that repertoire going forward. And it's vastly different than if you're buying an existing repertoire that has a history of decades of earnings, and you can sort of have a sense of how this is going to perform going forward. So the complexity around a younger vintage is different, and the dynamics are different, which pushes a lot of buyers away. But I can tell you, we buy more recent vintages, right? Because we have a deep understanding of earning curves, and we feel comfortable doing that. I would also say that there used to be almost a stigma of selling your repertoire if you were 30 years old, right? I think that stigma has changed completely, right? I think creators are not looking at their own works, and I'm generalizing here. Obviously, you have also a lot of people that are attached to their work and not necessarily willing to part ways. But what I've seen and noticed, I've seen writer producers being willing to sell a repertoire that is a few years old, right? And not necessarily waiting until a point in their career to have a large transaction, because they believe, and some of them are making the right bet, that they can do it again. So they mm-hmm. are taking advantage of a market and essentially capitalizing on what they are building and writing at intervals that are very different than what it used to be.
Yeah.
You know, Bill, I think it's a little addition to that is the, you know, back in the day, you know, yes, there was a prejudice, I think a prejudice against newer catalogs, but the window of what people are looking at has changed, right? So remember, we used to sell catalogs a few years ago and they'd be looking 5 years back, and then it was 3 years back. And I think as the market's gotten more volatile, the look back is a little bit shorter, which I think helps some of the young catalogs, I mean, depending on the genre. You know, you used to have a longer track record to do the financial modeling, but the look back is so short now, it's less disadvantageous, or say more mm-hmm. advantageous to the young artist.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what kinds of changes recently have, do you think that we've sort of hit peak catalog acquisition, or do you, you know, what, or, and what kind of changes are we seeing now? Of course, we're seeing tumultuous changes in the world and the economics of the world. So, I mean, that's a loaded question in a sense. I didn't mean to, but yeah, I mean, how do you answer that? It's hard to know where it's going. But what have you guys noticed in terms of, I mean, are all of the biggest catalogs bought up, or are there still quite a few that haven't been bought yet? And, you know, are those assets holding their value? I mean, we've already touched on this a little bit, but what are your thoughts about, you know, things now that maybe for 2020 versus when Dylan sold his catalog for $300 million to Universal Music Group, his compositions versus now? Do you think if he were selling it now that he would have gotten the same price? Let me put it to you that way. And I'm asking you to speculate, but...
I think it's likely that they would. Obviously, the cost of money is different today than it was in 2020. But interestingly, we haven't seen enormous amount of multiple compression with the cost of money going up quite significantly over the recent years. So my view is that if it was a strategic buyer, which it was in this particular case, I think a strategic buyer would probably value it the same way that it did then. A financial sponsor may value it slightly differently because they may be more sensitive to cost of money than a strategic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bill, the analogy we were talking about in class was it's almost like a real estate market. When a real estate market starts to go soft, you can still get the price that you want, but you may not get a three full price offers the first afternoon you put it on the market. But if you're a little patient, I mean, that's what we've seen here at GT, is the great catalogs still get tremendous prices for them, but it's not quite the feeding frenzy that maybe it was 18 months ago. Mm-hmm. And maybe like many areas of the economy, you know, the pyramid's getting steeper and steeper. So I think the premier catalogs are doing, you know, to Laurent's point, are probably doing just as well. But you may not see the same response in a mid-level catalog that you might have seen 18 to 24 months ago. Because as Laurent said, cost of money, there have been some stumbles about, you know, some of the market makers have stumbled. And so it's not, you know, it isn't quite as frothy, but I think the strong catalogs do just as well. That's what we've seen.
So we've been talking about publishing versus recording. And just for those listening that may not understand that music industry distinction, it's the recording is a different ownership, a different copyright than the actual song itself, the composition. And the music publisher is involved in the composition, and the music labels are involved in the recordings. So my question is, like, how, and oftentimes it's a lot easier in terms of ownership, because you got with the recordings more, maybe one owner, you know, a label, maybe the owner shares it with the artist. And then with the compositions, you could have 12 writers on a big Beyonce song or something like that. It's not like back with, when Queen, you had Bohemian Rhapsody, you know, Freddie Mercury, one writer, you know, those days. Well, we still have those days, but the modern pop song today has got loads of writers. And doesn't that make it tricky in terms of if you're selling catalogs? I think we touched on this before, but I just wanted to hear a bit more about the approach to buying compositions versus the approach to buying recordings, which are two different things.
I mean, what we observed in the market is the spread between master and publishing is narrowing. It used to be that you would see 4 or 5 terms difference. And what we see today is a number south of that, right? So you would see maybe 2 to 3 terms instead of 4 or 5 terms. What I mean by that is the multiple to a publishing exceeding the multiple of a master, right? So we've seen that narrowing, right? And I think that's exactly the product of what you said, which is publishing has the benefit of not being a product, right? It could take the form of many different versions, as opposed to a recording that is a finite product. So you would expect that publishing, giving that optionality, carries a premium. But the counter argument to that is the complexity around licensing, right? Which, as we said earlier, because you have a fragmentation of ownership, has gone up, versus on recorded music side, things are easier from a licensing perspective. But there's another aspect, which is if you look at how, in the US at the very least, how music publishing is heavily regulated compared to masters. So if you look in the US, my argument via CRB and consent decree on mechanical and performance respectively, that both of those regulations have depressed value as opposed to increased value, right? You don't have the same impact on recorded music. So the fact that you are much more in a willing buyer-seller environment on the master side than you are on the publishing contributes to perhaps that increase of multiples compared to publishing.
What do you think, Jeff, to you?
I agree with that. Yeah, I mean, a song can be recorded so many times. You would think, right? I mean, Laurent's absolutely right, but, you know, it is the licensing, so much of our job, and I know you're in the same space too. Music, you know, from the publishing side, licensing is a challenge, you know, especially mm-hmm. depending on the genre, running down every little piece. That's a problem. That can't be a problem.
Absolutely, yeah.
Again, in these big catalog sales, it's a huge part of the diligence process, and I know you're in that in those trenches too. Some of those songs are very difficult to diligence if they're old and there are many, many writers.
You know, we haven't gotten into like termination rights, and we don't want to go too far into that, down that rabbit hole. But yeah, it can get tricky. As you were saying, both of you, that it can get a lot trickier on the composition side because of the regulation and the Copyright Act. Well, it applies to master recordings, the termination rights. We don't need to go too into that, but it is complicated, I guess. More complicated in some ways on the composition side. They used to say, I think it's an old saying that, you know, old school music saying that, you know, an artist would buy a successful artist, singer, song who writes their own songs would get there, buy the fancy sports car with the record royalties, but buy the house with the publishing royalties, because they can pay over longer time, you know, mortgage or whatever it is. That was sort of a thing. As far as like buying catalogs versus buying master recordings, you know, would seem, and it is, it would seem to be trickier with compositions sometimes, but is Cobalt also involved in master recording purchases or more on the compositional side?
Occasionally we buy masters. You know, we lack the opportunity to buy corresponding masters and publishing. So you have an overlap, which we were talking about licensing earlier. That will give you obviously an opportunity to unlock greater value because you control both sides. So you can license 200% now. So there's a benefit there. But we rarely buy master only. That's rare for us. But we've bought masters often when they are associated with a corresponding publishing interest.
So let me ask you guys about film scores and music, and well, film scores primarily. There's music in films, but there's also the scores themselves. And, you know, are these interesting acquisitions? You have composers like Koji Kondo of Japan, who, you know, created the Super Mario themes that people, you know, play them like as cover songs. You know, people play these things. I went to a show for a client who was performing his game score with an orchestra, and the people in the audience were like, it was all young kids, and they knew everything. They knew the music. I mean, it's really a thing.
They have been at the bowl every year.
Right. So is that interesting, acquisitions of film scores? Now, you're going to be buying it from a studio more than likely, right? Because it's usually a work for hire to the studio.
Yeah. I mean, I think they are valuable rights. I mean, I'm sure you've seen the transactions with Cutting Edge and Warner recently. I would say from our perspective is trying to understand the earning profile of those interests, because you've had an enormous transformation of consumption. I mean, if you think about how movies or AV products are being consumed today, that's vastly different than it was 10 years ago. The vast majority of consumption now is on AV platforms, whether it's a Netflix and HBO Max or others. The rate setting around the value there is a work in progress, I would put it that way. So you'd have a transition from a very steady performance payments that we've seen over years that is moving slightly into what I would say the distribution platforms. And I think that creates, in my view, some uncertainty. It doesn't mean that you necessarily handicap the value, but I think you need to understand exactly what that means. What I've seen, though, based on some assets reviewed or some other buyers that have talked about this asset class with respect to film and TV, is that in most cases, they've seen growth, right? So it looks like much like catalog in the context of streaming, there is demand for catalog in terms of movies, right? And that always surprised me a little bit because, you know, it's natural to be listening to the same songs you've listened to based on your life experience, but it's not often that you're watching same movie over and over again, right? So I always felt that from a pure consumption perspective, that would be handicapped. But What we see is that it's not necessarily the case. Why? Because those platforms are bringing those old movies to new audiences, right? Because if you think about this, before this platform existed, where would you watch those old movies? You'd have to go to the video store where you had to wait for them to be on TV. Now you have video on demand, so you have the ability to tap into any, I mean, I when I'm on my TV, I can type literally any title, and I do that sometimes for old French movies, and I always find them, whether it's on YouTube, whether it's on Netflix, whether it's on any of those platforms, Tubi or whatever it is, I find them. And that will create demand, and it has already created demand, which means that it will create earnings.
Yeah, I kind of confused my question a little bit because I was talking about movies, and then I kind of gave an example about a game soundtrack, but they kind of go together. I mean, it's the Minecraft movie, the first real blockbuster of the year, and it's, I have to say, it's hilarious if you have a chance to see it. It's great. And I have a client who did the music. It's not Mark Mothersbaugh who did the score, but he's created my client some music for ancillary things, like involving the games and promotions and things like that. And it's a big deal. But I think, as you said earlier, Laurent, it's not really well integrated. The game music and the film music, it doesn't make the kind of money that it should probably for the music part of it. I mean, you can have a soundtrack record, yes, but in terms of, you know, we don't have a royalty in the U.S. for songs that are performing here. Do you think that should change, and that the, you know, marketplace could be better from the music ownership people if we recognized or we paid more for music on in film and games? I guess I'm putting them together in this question. I hope my question makes sense.
Laurent, you would have to pay more for your music in films and games?
Yeah.
Of course you do, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think music in movies has had an extraordinary success, right? If you think about Titanic, right? That's an older example. And then you're going to take another example like the show The Bear. I don't know if you watched the show, where music was a defining moment in the context of the experience. So you have those moments, right? But it's also true that it is not as often as it used to be. It used to be that film scoring and the investment by the studios in music was very significant. Given the economics around the movie business, which unfortunately is far more challenging, music has not necessarily been as defining, and at least that's my experience, when it comes to movies, right? It's if I were to ask you and say, can you give me five scores in the past 10 years of high relevance, I think you'd be struggling to give me those five scores, right? Had I asked that question 20 years ago, I think it would be very different. So it's a mixed answer from my perspective, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
you know, we do a bunch of these composer deals, Bill. They're unusual in that the vast majority of music these folks write is work for hire. So yeah, they're not selling copyrights, they're selling income streams. But the market's still been good for them. And, you know, there's some, like, I always think of Multimedia Music out of London that just specializes in composer deals. But you're mm-hmm. selling an income stream as opposed to a copyright, so it's a different multiple structure.
That's right.
Interesting. What about name and likeness rights? Okay, the use of a celebrity's image, name, even voice. Are those an asset class that you're dealing with as well in packaging with the music rights?
For sure. Well, they certainly ask for it. And it depends on, again, on the family, the age of, you know, or living and death status of a particular artist. But that's definitely a question, right? And again, way back to the beginning of the conversation, depends on how active your client is in wants to keep in protecting and working that legacy, right, of their relative in a legacy situation. It's probably even more intense with a living artist, right? I can't imagine they'd give that up. But in a legacy situation, you know, again, if you're looking for that biggest check, I'll give you an example. Helped a client sell an estate, And there was one child left in that estate, and the child was disabled. So it was, even though an adult child, wasn't capable of managing it as an ongoing business, right? So in that sense, it didn't make sense to keep the name and likeness rights separate from the music, because the heir couldn't monetize, couldn't protect, couldn't work to manage those rights.
Mm-hmm.
If you have an active family, I think that'd be a different question.
Yeah. Wow, I can't believe we've gone this far, almost to the end of the hour, and we haven't talked about AI music. I mean, that's unbelievable. I mean, it seems like every podcast having to do with music, and everybody's talking about AI music. And let's just touch on it a little bit. There's a couple of things about AI music. One is, it's a good tool for, you know, for instance, copyright infringement. It does things like helps with content identification and things like that. As a tool in that way, it's good in the music industry. But then you have Suno and Udio, those lawsuits, and Gamma in Europe involving unauthorized use of music in the data sets that they're using to generate music. And it could be, I guess you could say, it could be an existential threat to human-created music. No, I did a panel one time at South by Southwest on called "Can Robots Create Life-Changing Songs?" You know, we had, when we asked ChatGPT at the time, it was a few years ago, create a life-changing song lyric, and of course it was terrible. You know, it was garbage. But then we said, okay, create a life-changing song in the style of Lou Reed, and it spit out something, and it says, "Take a walk on the wild side" was one of the lines. And we're like, okay, that's copyright infringement. Let's do it again. It didn't do it the second time. The third time it did it again. You know, it's like, I think they've probably tweaked the algorithm by now, but it is, to me, it sounds like it's a threat to, in some ways, maybe I'm overstating it, but to the value of human created catalogs. Now, as an attorney, Jeff, I mean, you can't get a copyright on, a computer can't get a copyright, right? Neither can a monkey taking a selfie or and so on, you know. But is AI music going to impact the value in a good way or a bad way of music catalogs that are for sale? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it depends on the genre, Bill. But yeah. I just got back from Nashville yesterday morning, and interesting thing, I was asking every songwriter I bumped into about AI. And some of the things seem pretty benign. I mean, I talked to one writer who said that before they were going to a write, that they asked the AI to come up with a bunch of country titles. Mm-hmm. And so they walked in with these 50 different country titles. And obviously, you know, the folks in the room wrote a song based on that. So that was human creation, but they used it as kind of a germinative of an idea. So that seemed fairly benign.
Well, you know, there's one song title that I love, a country song title. I don't think it exists, but it's called "I Still Miss You, But My Aim Is Getting Better." Now, I don't think that AI would ever come up with that, because it doesn't get sarcasm. No. But
I've heard that, you know, some folks occasionally they're getting stuck and they're using AI. I think that's a little bit more concerning. And, you know, look, I'm curious how Laurent feels about this. I think it depends on the use. Like, for instance, I've done a bunch of work with production music catalogs. And to me, that's the most immediate danger, right? I mean, you know, a song is a song is a song. But, you know, if you're looking just for music cues for a horror film, you know, you already saw that problem in production music catalogs over the last 5 years, as that people started subscribing to them, right? And it became a bit of a race to the bottom, and it hurt the value of those catalogs, right? If it was all you could eat, individual works had less value. Well, to me, if AI is starting to put together music cues for a horror movie or a romantic story or whatever it is, that's a serious problem, because that your discerning music consumer may not notice it as a music cue, whereas they definitely notice it as a ballad, I think.
No, I think, yeah, for background music, but I say music, AI can't create great music because computers can't cry, you know, and I think great music comes from a deep place, you know, and AI doesn't really feel anything.
At least not yet, Bill.
I don't think ever. Let me die before that happens, please. Hopefully a long time from now. But I don't think so. I don't know. I don't believe the...
I hope you're right.
But does it, Laurent, do you think that AI is a threat to catalog sales, or is it a good thing? You know, it could actually be a positive, I suppose.
I mean, I think speaking today, we know AI will be incredibly consequential, right? In what ways, I think it's hard to tell. What I would tell you is, based on the conversation with many of our clients, they use AI every day, and they see AI as a tool to expand their capabilities and their creative abilities, right? So it is used as an enhancer, right? Now, does that change the mix of a writing room? Maybe in the room when you would need three writers, maybe you only need two, and I don't know who is getting squeezed. Is it a high-end writer, the middle level? We don't know, and I think that will play out in some way. So that's the creation part of it, right? In terms of value erosion, you can make both cases, right? You can make the case that AI will increase the supply of music, which means that non-AI music may actually retain greater value, right? If people are distinguishing non-AI music from AI repertoire, and that could be a value enhancer. Now, depending on where the consumption goes, because let's face it, at the end of the day, all of this will be driven by consumption. You and I can argue about quality, right? But it doesn't really matter, right? What matters is what are people listening to? And you may have over time a generational shift. I mean, we have a sense of what is great music for us, or what music makes us feel something, right? A generation down, maybe not, because that generation may not have had the same music experience or music exposure that we've had. So it's very hard to tell what will be the outcome, but it is most certainly going to be extremely consequential. Now, you have other aspects of AI that I think will be a great benefit, because AI will at some point also can be the DNA of music, because with perfect attribution, you will have a core DNA for every song. When today we are arguing between one musicologist and another, then over time those arguments will probably be very different than they are today, because AI may be the referee in those conversations.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's absolutely right. Yeah.
So, Bill, what about the North Carolina case, right? Where, I mean, not really creating music, but using AI to defraud music, where you're creating bots that are upsetting the Spotify division of income. So AI is affecting music both ends of the business, creatively and the business side.
No, and thankfully they caught that guy. But yeah, very good point.
But what we must be very careful and very vigilant is what is happening in the UK, for instance, which I'm sure you're aware of, where you have tech companies using AI as a vector of arguing copyright. Right? That is, in my view, something that is of great concern. Right? So AI may provide great capabilities, and we covered that, but we should be very vigilant that AI does not become that excuse, that reason why tech companies will argue for copyright reform. And by the way, this is something they've been arguing for 30 years. You know what I mean? Let's not forget that the last piece of legislation is the DMCA in the US. I'm talking US. Is the DMCA in 1999. Right? So many world changes occurred since then. And what is happening in the UK, as I'm sure you're aware, is concerning. And when you have a Jack Dorsey and Elon Musk piling on and saying, well, essentially copyright is dead and irrelevant. That is something that we must, as an industry, and not only the music industry, all creative industry, we must absolutely understand the level of threat that it might represent, because that is existential. We can argue on the dilution of AI here and there, and that's, you know, a business problem that we can manage, I believe, but this can be an existential issue.
Wow. You know, that's amazing. And I'm going to pick that up on the next, probably the next podcast episode with Peter, copyright attorneys, litigators, Peter Anderson, who won the Stairway to Heaven case and many others, and Aaron Moss, talking about some of this, you know, about the copy, because as you say, I mean, Elon Musk and Jack Dorsey talking about we don't need copyright law anymore. Okay. But that will take up on another, we certainly need another episode for that. But well, I want to really, yeah, ask you if you have anything else that you want to say, because I'm so grateful to have you both on this podcast. Have we covered it?
Laurent, you had a finger up? You have one more comment?
No, I mean, no, I think, and I imagine Jeff would agree with me, is that I feel incredibly blessed to be in this industry, to have the opportunity to work with extremely talented people, both on the talent side and on the executive side. And I do feel that we have a sense of purpose in what we do every day. And AI might be actually one that would also rally all of us to make sure that we understand what is our ultimate mission, which is to protect creators and enable them to do what they do best, and in some ways changing the world one song at a time. And I feel very lucky to be able to contribute humbly to that.
Hear, hear.
Well, amen. And thank you guys so much for a wonderful conversation. I really appreciate it. And we'll have to have you back on again. Sure. So thanks so much.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
Thanks, Laurent. Bye-bye.